rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All representatives before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the court. I'm here today with my colleagues, Judge Meredith on my right and Judge Falvey on my left. The time we have set for oral argument in Pat A. Hatfield versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 21-5125. Would counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Adam Luck of Luck, Dallas, Texas.
Thank you, Mr. Luck.
Mark Hamill for the Secretary, and with me is Deputy Chief Counsel James Cowden.
Welcome. Mr. Luck, I understand that you want to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, we've made that happen, and so you can begin whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Judge Allen, Judge Meredith, Judge Falvey. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. May it please the court. This case involves Ms. Hatfield's request for revision of her 1980 board decision that denied entitlement to compensation and DIC benefits. Ms. Hatfield asserted that the 1980 board decision contained clear and unmistakable error because it failed to apply the laws regarding informed consent and compensation at the time of 1980. The board conceded that as of the 1980 board decision, the law required the VA to obtain the veteran's informed consent, but ultimately denied Ms. Hatfield's request for revision, concluding that the law regarding compensation did not allow for informed consent to serve as the proximate cause for compensation purposes as it does today. The board based its decision on the reasons Ms. Hatfield's subsequent 2010 claim was granted. The law as it stands now, changes in the current law, and case law published after the 1980 board decision. But case law from this court, the Federal Circuit, and the Supreme Court make clear that Q determinations are to be based on the record and the law that existed at the time of the decision being attacked. So the reasons why Ms. Hatfield's 2010 claim were granted, Section 3.361, Brown v. Garner, Hatfield v. McDonough, or any other changes in fact or law, did not exist at the time of the board decision, so those items should not have entered into the board's analysis when interpreting the 1980 law.
Do you have any, we couldn't find any, my law clerk and I, any examples of a decision in or around 1980 that granted disability compensation based on an informed consent violation?
Interesting question, Your Honor. We know that judicial review, this court wasn't around back then, so Ms. Hatfield turned to case law that existed in the private sector when looking for failure to obtain informed consent.
I understand sort of common law backdrop, right? Yes. I'm asking, do you have any I didn't want to frame it this way, but do you have any evidence, meaning a board decision, a regional office decision, something you picked up at a water cooler somewhere, that says that in or around 1980, the VA, the Veterans Administration at the time, awarded disability compensation under then Section 351 based on a lack of informed consent?
No, Your Honor. We're not able to look or to locate any regional office rating decisions from that time. Those are not searchable. And we have not come across any in our law firm, given the rarity of this type of case. And we did not find any board decisions specifically interpreting 351 or addressing a failure to obtain informed consent.
So what is the impact, of any, of what appears to be an absence of proof, evidence, about what VA did at the time. Where does that fall, if at all, on the scales here?
Well, I don't think that there is a complete absence of proof. There are other authority that existed at the time of the 1980 decision, Your Honor, that indicates how 3.358 and 351 was interpreted and understood, specifically speaking of Congress's express intent behind 351, OGC's October 1978 presidential decision that reviewed the legislative history of 351, as well as the implementing regulation 3.358, and noting that Congress did intend recovery for any type of negligence or indicated fault on the part of the VA.
So let's start with Congress. It seems to me that both 351 and 1151, the parties seem in agreement, don't expressly say anything about informed consent one way or the other.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay. So only a few years before the board decision at issue here in 1980, in 1976, Congress amended Section 351 to make some technical changes. And simultaneously, but in a different bill, enacted the informed consent statute. What should we take from that? Because it would seem to me that if Congress enacted the informed consent statute at the same time it was amending 351, but yet didn't say anything about it, that might be some evidence about what Congress was intending.
Well, I think, Your Honor, viewing the interplay between those two statutes, not viewing them in isolation or separate from each other, answers that question. So when Congress passed Section 351, it specifically stated that the intent behind it was to protect veterans through compensation from medical malpractice committed by the VA. And Congress...
What year are you talking about now?
That was back in 1934.
Okay, yeah, you don't have to be specific. But, I mean, you're not talking about before 1976, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're not saying that at the time during the 1930s, when Congress enacted the predecessor to 1151, you're not suggesting that at that time Congress intended for informed consent to be a basis for disability compensation, are you?
I'm not, Your Honor, but Congress used the medical malpractice, the broad language of medical malpractice, knowing that there's not a specific type of medical malpractice, not limiting the coverage of Section 351. So knowing that the presence of 351 and its desire to protect veterans from medical malpractice, when Congress passed Section 4131, creating that duty on the VA to obtain informed consent prior to rendering medical care, it's understanding that those protections, those duties, would fall under the umbrella of that medical malpractice. There's no need to restate under the provisions requiring informed consent under 4131. This was also a medical malpractice type of issue. And I think that's because of what we saw in the common law that existed at the time that's acknowledging the failure to obtain informed consent prior to rendering medical care constitutes that compensable negligence. It constitutes medical malpractice.
But when did that, that's not always been the case. The lack of informed consent was viewed as a battery. If you performed a medical treatment without informed consent, you could be viewed as having committed a tortious battery. And it's only more recently, under the common law, that the lack of informed consent was seen as a type of negligence.
Well, Your Honor, so that is correct, that common law does equate, in certain circumstances, failure to obtain informed consent as a form of battery. The problem with that analysis, in Ms. Hatfield's view, though, is because this court was not created, because we did not have judicial review, we're stuck with common law in the private sector that really makes state-specific decisions on a state-by-state basis. So interpreting how informed consent fits into the medical malpractice picture.
Do you have any authority that says in 1980 the majority position in common law states I guess it's everything but Louisiana, I guess.
Ms. Hatfield did not do a state-by-state analysis.
Okay, so when you say that the law provided that negligence or that the lack of informed consent was viewed as negligence, undebatably so, what's your authority?
My authority is case law that existed at the time, specifically from the state of Texas, where the treatment that VA provided occurred. And also through the court's decision in Canterbury v. Federal Circuit Court of Claims decision in Canterbury v. Spence that discusses the informed consent requirements and discusses as well some of the case law interpreting the failure to obtain that informed consent. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Can I jump in? Trying to get back to figuring out what it is that's before the court right now. I know Judge Allen did a briefing order on arguments pertaining to 3.58 and whether those represent a new Q theory this year. And so I want to go back to what you argued in the 2020 Q motion. And it was basically that the plain language, as I read your Q motion, of 3.51, 41, 31, and the regulation 17.34. The plain language of those three provisions compelled the result that compensation was warranted under these circumstances. So to the extent we're not talking about negligence, which only appeared in 3.358 at that time, it wasn't in the provisions you cited, and common law, how are those arguments before us?
Those arguments are before this court because they were those issues were addressed by the board. And I think the board correctly understood Ms. Hatfield's Q pleading regarding Section 351 as also including within the scope of 351, Section 3.358, which is the implementing regulation for that statute.
So your position is even though a Q motion through counsel did not mention that regulation or make any arguments pertaining to 3.358, that there was nevertheless an issue that the board could address?
Yes, Your Honor, and the parties concede that this is not a new Q theory, but in furtherance of the Q theory raised at the board.
And so I thought in some of the pleadings of addressing jurisdiction, it had to do with the board in the decision on appeal said, as part of its reasons for denying Q, that the law since 1980 had changed, and part of the reason was comparing 3.358 to 3.361. And to that extent, if we have jurisdiction, is that separate from trying to show that in 1980 the board erred because of perhaps a misinterpretation of the word negligence or failure to apply common law? Are those not two separate issues of whether the board in 2021 erred in what they said or trying to show that there was Q in 1980?
I believe those are two separate issues, Your Honor, and we're reviewing the board's decision on appeal here, which did rely on that change in law. It relied on the subsequent law to interpret the 1980 law, and that's, I think, clearly contrary to precedential case law.
So to that extent, and I believe that's how you started out, was that the board maybe not should not have addressed whether the law had changed after 1980. If your arguments as to 3.358 are mostly just attacking the board decision that talked about 3.58, do we need to address those arguments in order to address the Q allegation that they should have been addressing, which was the plain language of the three other provisions led to the result that you're seeking? Why are those arguments relevant as to whether there was error in 1980?
So the board's decision, Your Honor, when interpreting the 1980 law through the lens of the current law and changes in the law, misinterpreted the 1980 law. And that's where the board's analysis gets hung up, is that it only cited to authority that existed after the 1980 board decision, but not any authority that existed at the time of the 1980 board decision that would shed light on how its interpretation of the 1980 law would have been. So in addressing what the law said in 1980, the court has to address how the board arrived at that determination and its legally erroneous analysis of relying on the current law.
And so we agree that the board should not have talked about anything other than the three provisions that you mentioned in your Q motion. then why would we get into the issues of common law and what did negligence mean? Because those were not part of the Q motion.
Well, the problem with the board's decision, Your Honor, is that the board addressed 3.358. So to the extent that 3.358 is not before the board, excuse me, before the court, the board has precluded that from being raised as an initial Q theory by adjudicating what 3.358 said at the time of the 1980 decision through the lens of what the current law says now and changes in the current law.
This was Q as to a board decision, though. Are you suggesting you could raise a subsequent Q motion as to it?
I can no longer raise that subsequent Q motion because the board adjudicated but what?
Q as to a board decision, though. Are you saying you could have multiple Q motions? I believe it's Hilliard is the case I'm thinking of.
Well, if the allegation of 3.358 is a separate Q pleading in general, that would be a separate Q pleading in its entirety. I believe I'm following your question.
So let me put it this way. If we disregard anything the board said post-1980, their arguments, we agree with you that they were wrong to talk about anything other than what did the law in 1980 mean. Are you conceding that it would be a new Q theory raised here for the first time for us to look at? Should the board have applied 3.358 in 1980 in the way that you're suggesting? Is that a new Q theory because it was not raised in the Q motion and it was not addressed in the board decision as to how do you interpret negligence in 1980?
I do not think it was a new Q theory, Your Honor. And as I was explaining to Judge Allen, I think the board properly interpreted the scope of Ms. Hatfield's Q pleading to include the application of 3.358 in conjunction with her allegations under 351.
So let me ask you this question. I'm not entirely following the idea that the board couldn't refer to anything after 1980, but let's leave that aside because my question does go to something after 1980. You in some of your submissions, talk about the regulatory changes that occurred in the early 2000s, 2002, 2004. You with me on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you talk about the fact that those changes, which discuss informed consent, right, this is where that was, merely was a continuation of the existing regulation. Sure. But what you don't mention is that the existing regulation was not the regulatory framework that existed in 1980. It was put into place into 1995, which is when the first concrete mentions of informed consent come into play in response to Brown versus Gardner. So why isn't the 1995 regulatory history strong evidence that there was a change from what had existed prior?
So aside from that, I have 3 minutes.
Don't worry about the time. In our world, it's just aspirational. So
thank you, Your Honor. Aside from the issue that the board was not allowed to consider.
So let me just stop you there, and then you can answer my question, but I'm going to interrupt myself, which is, are you saying, let's just assume a world in which there's something that happens in 1980 that's the subject of Q, and in 1990, VA enacts a regulation, and the regulation in the Federal Register says, this is an entire change of the meaning, the interpretation of the law, right? It actually says that. Are you suggesting it's error to look at that to decide whether the earlier, whether there in fact has been a change?
I do, Your Honor. And if we're sticking to precedential case law that says we're limited to what existed at the time of the decision being attacked, a subsequent regulation, statutory provision, notice and comment, anything like that, that says this is a departure from an interpretation. And side note there is the board in this case is not relying on an interpretation. It's relying on a change in the law. And any authority that comes after, and it could be a case law as well, that says the law is changing or the interpretation is changing does not say how it was understood at the time of the 1980 board decision. And I think relying on that to interpret how the law was understood, as in Ms. Hatfield's case, caused the board to say, well, the law as it stands now explicitly references under 3.361D12 informed consent, but it didn't say that back then. It doesn't say how the law was understood back in 1980. It just explains that there is a difference in the law now.
Okay, well, assume then that I don't buy that, and so then you have to deal with the regulatory change in 1995. So how do you do that?
The fact that there was a regulatory change, also, if we're going to look at subsequent authority, then we need to look at how the board relied on that subsequent authority. Did it rely on a new interpretation? Did it rely on a change? Where is the line drawn between the law that existed at the time and subsequent authority explaining what the law said at the time of the board decision? And in figuring out where that line is drawn is where the reasons and bases come in. And the board's decision didn't – I see I'm out of time.
You can continue, Don. Could you put 5 minutes? Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. And the board's decision in this case didn't explain that we're relying on this subsequent authority because the notice and comment provisions or congressional intent or OGC's precedential opinions since 1980 have stated that this new change in the law adds a new element that was not in existence. It never said that these changes in the law were something new in addition and changed the way the law was understood at the time. I think in that circumstance, had the subsequent authority addressed how the law was understood and what the law said at the time and why these changes maybe were necessary, in that circumstance, we're not reinventing the wheel. We're explaining how the law was understood and the purpose of the need for the change. But that's not what happened in Ms. Hatfield's case, and the board didn't rely on such. The board just relied on a change in law and said these changes in the law were not present back in 1980.
So what is it about the general counsel's opinion that discusses evidence from an accident, rather, from 1978, I think it is, it doesn't appear to talk about informed consent. It talks about accidents.
Yes, Your Honor. So the October 78 OGC opinion, for the most part, addresses accident in response to the Federal Register. But in reviewing the legislative history of 351 and 3.358, noted that Congress intended recovery for some type of negligence or fault, not limiting the type of negligence, not limiting the type of fault to specific circumstances, not defining negligence or excluding a failure to obtain informed consent to serve as the proximate cause.
So what do you have then, without telling me anything that exists after 1980? Okay, so we'll play on your field here. What do you have that says directly that it is undebatable in 1980 that negligence for VA compensation purposes included a lack of informed consent?
So there's not an authority that specifically says that.
Then don't you lose? Because if there's no authority that specifically says that, then how can it be undebatable that that is the principle?
So the board interpreted 3.358C3, the proximate cause prong of that regulation, as an exhaustive list that excluded informed consent because the current section 3.361 included it as proximate cause. But viewing 3.358C3 as an exhaustive list is an incorrect interpretation because it is a non-exhaustive list. And the board's conclusion that informed consent was precluded from a non-exhaustive list, precluded as serving as proximate cause from this non-exhaustive list, was the error of law. And when viewing the interplay amongst 351, 4131, 3.358, and 1734, we see that Congress intended to protect veterans from medical malpractice. They intended to protect veterans by creating a duty on the VA to obtain informed consent. VA maintained these protections by mimicking the common law with 3.358 and 3.358A requiring the or mimicking the compensation portion of 351, and then C1 requiring actual causation, C3 requiring proximate causation through that non-exhaustive list. And again, common law from the time equating the breach of the duty to obtain informed consent with compensation, with compensable negligence, is that interplay that leads to a different result from what the board concluded was a exhaustive list that excluded informed consent. And VA didn't define negligence. It didn't define carelessness. And it included a catch-all phrase or other similar instance of indicated fault. And interpreting that as not excluding, that non-exhaustive list is not excluding any type of circumstance that would allow for proximate causation, could lead the board, had it analyzed the law that existed, the authority that existed at the time, to conclude that, yes, in fact, the law was understood to not preclude a failure to obtain informed consent, but to include a failure to obtain informed consent as proximate cause, which is directly in conflict with the board's actual decision in this case, Your Honor.
Just one follow-up question on that. As I mentioned earlier, you cited three specific provisions in your Q motion, 351, 4131, and 1734. To Joe Jones' point, how do you are you arguing that those provisions themselves in 1980 undebatably led to the conclusion that you're advocating for? Or do we need to look at other things that were not mentioned in the Q motion, like 3.358 and common law?
I would say the three specific laws referenced, viewed in combination with other things like the common law, the OGC's precedent opinion, leads to the correct analysis. So considering those other items as well, the discussion of common law that existed at the time of the 1980 board decision is at record 53 and 54. Just so you're aware, Your Honor, Ms. Hatfield did not reference the OGC's October 1978 precedent opinion.
Just one follow-up question about your discussion of 3.358C3. What in there allows you to claim that it's a non-exhaustive list?
I think the plain language shows that it's a non-exhaustive
list. What language specifically?
Specifically the catch-all phrase at the end. So C3 lists carelessness, negligence, lack of proper skill, error in judgment, but then includes the catch-all phrase at the end, or similar instance of indicated fault on the part.
So is it that language, the or similar instances?
That language, as well as the VA's, the fact that the VA did not define or limit terms like negligence, carelessness, error in judgment, et cetera.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Oh, I see I still have 3 minutes. Do you mind if I...
You can wrap up.
Just to reiterate one quick point that the Secretary made in supplemental briefing that the board relied on changes in the law, the clear differences among the current law and the former law, but then argued that comparing the current law to the former law was both misplaced and misguided. But that's exactly what the board did in this situation. And because the board compared the current law to the former law and relied on that comparison to deny Ms. Hatfield's case, his decision cannot be in accordance with Percivale and George. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hamill, if you need some extra time, we'll accommodate you at the end as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The granting of a cure motion requires the showing of undebatable error. It must be an error of such magnitude that reasonable minds cannot differ. We do not have that here. To start, I'd like to briefly note some facts that give context to the two important decisions in this appeal. The first important decision is the October 1980 board decision. The October 1980 board decision was issued by a three-member panel that included a medical doctor, record page 1657. The 1980 board decision found that the treatment plan and treatment were within the bounds of accepted medical practice. At that time, the implementing regulation 3.358 provided for benefits under section 351 for negligent acts, but not for lack of informed consent. Fast forward to September 2020. Appellant filed a motion for revision of that 1980 board decision. This is at record 195. The motion was prepared by an attorney. The motion was fairly short and concise, and the motion relied on a misapplication of two statutes. I think it's already been mentioned, 351, 4131, and one regulation, 1734. And now fast forward again to June 4th, 2021. That is the date of the board decision that is the subject of this appeal. That board decision directly responded to the specific arguments raised in the September 2020 Q motion. The board found that the law regarding compensation under 351, as it was known at the time of the October 1980 board decision, did not require documentation of informed consent for the underlying medical care. The board noted that the current 38 CFR 3.361 contains language that states that providing medical care without informed consent is a type of fault for which 1151 benefits may be granted. There was no such regulation in 1980 with similar language.
Could you give me the Secretary's position on the argument that any reference to something that happened after 1980 is inappropriate in this context?
Your Honor, when a court, when a judicatory body is looking at what the law is at one point in time and the law has subsequently changed, it's got to be appropriate. If the board had not talked about the fact that we now currently have a statute that authorizes this, he would be arguing that the board erred in not addressing that because, look, it must not have changed. So I think it behooves the board to address the issue that the current law, as we commonly understand it, provides that the lack of informed consent will provide a basis now for relief under 1151. So I think that was just an obvious thing the board needed to address in this case and probably would have been faulted for not. So the board relied on three things. So the board relied on the language. The board also explained that equivalent regulation from 1980, 3.358, specifically listed instances of fault that would warrant relief under 351, but there's no reference to informed consent in that regulation. And then the board also noted that in 1994, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down 3.358, which further shows the state of the law in this area has changed since 1980. This legal analysis is sound.
What's your response to Mr. Luck's argument that other similar instances in 3.358 demonstrates that it's a non-exhaustive list and therefore encompasses informed consent or may encompass informed consent?
Your Honor, I think that's an argument he could make, but it does not undercut the board's reliance on the fact that the statutes were different back then. And I would also point to the fact that we have a board decision from 1980 that talked about the treatment being within the bounds of accepted medical practice. So there's also further indication in this case that back in 1980,
this was not considered a problem to not give informed consent. So it's perhaps an argument that could be made, but when we're talking about something that constitutes Q, it's got to be undebatable. It's got to be unreasonable for the board to rely on what it relied on in this case. And because the board relied on the plain language, and it's undisputable that the regulations and the statutes have changed and the law has changed, the board was certainly within its bounds to rely on what it did. But what appellant tries to undermine the board's decision in two ways. First, with reliance on the Federal Register comments from 2002 and 2004 regarding the proposed and final versions of 3.361, which is the current implementing regulation of 1151. This does not undermine the board's decision. Much happened between 1980 and 2002. Brown v. Gardner struck down 3.358. The governing statute, 351, had been renumbered to 1151 and revised. The comments in the Federal Register are also in the present tense. So it says proposed 3.361 is derived from. And the language from 2004 says the language was intended to merely restate standards governing determinations of negligence.
And I don't think that the Secretary pointed out this either, but the appellant didn't either, but it seems to me that those statements that you just quoted are actually helpful to the Secretary's position because the change was in 1995. So the is derived, it seems to me, goes back to the immediate antecedent as opposed to going back to what existed before. Would you agree with that?
Correct, Your Honor. So in 2002 and 2004, it's essentially a snapshot of what we were thinking the law was in 2002 and 2004, which has significantly changed since 1980. And I do briefly want to talk about appellant's reliance on common law. And here, this was not raised in appellant's Q motion. The suggestion is almost that appellant raised a Q motion and relied on two statutes and one regulation, and somehow the board should have been incumbent upon the board to do a survey of the common law in all the states and try and figure out if that might have supported appellant's argument, but that's not required. The board's decision.
Can I ask you this? In 1980, so VA had a duty to provide informed consent to patients at the time, right? That was enacted in 1976. Is that right?
Kind of, Your Honor.
So, this isn't a trap, no, but right, explain to me, kind of.
So back in 1976, there was a statute that required VA to implement regulations to ensure that implied consent would be provided. Right. That regulation was passed in 1980 and made retroactive to 1976.
So the point I'm getting at here is if we treat that, which was part of the patient's bill of rights or something that I think, as something separate from compensation, disability compensation. Okay, start out with that. A person arguably wouldn't have been foreclosed from getting money for a violation of a duty, perhaps, to provide informed consent, because wouldn't they have been able to still bring an action under the Federal Tort Claims Act?
Yes, sure, and that would be state-specific. So depending upon...
No, that's what I mean. So in that sense, right, the mere fact that there was a... It might not be a checkerboard, but it wasn't a universally colored groundwork of common law out there in the world. The common law could be relevant for an individual claimant in 1980, even if it was totally irrelevant for determining disability compensation, right, because they could have arguably sued, and if they were in a state that adopted informed consent as part of negligence or even battery, for that matter, the Federal Tort Claims Act could have provided an avenue for recovery, even if Congress had not yet extended this to disability compensation.
Correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that. But, and I would like to just briefly touch on Canterbury. So Canterbury was one of the main cases that appellant relied on. But Canterbury doesn't support appellant's argument. Canterbury, on page 783, states that the duty to disclose has gained recognition in a large number of American jurisdictions. In a footnote on that page, footnote 37, that decision states that the number is 22. So 22 out of the 50 states recognize the duty to disclose. And then that decision also notes on page 786, the larger number of courts, as might be expected, have applied tests framed with reference to prevailing fashion within the medical profession. So even amongst the 22 states, the majority didn't have a strict liability rule about informed consent. It was a matter of whether this was under the prevailing fashion of the medical practice at the time. So the Canterbury case doesn't really support that there was some underlying common law that the board needed to look into that undermines the board decision that back in 1980, there was no clear and unmistakable error in not finding that there was some kind of entitlement under 351 due to the lack of informed consent. But so neither this case, Canterbury, nor any of the other cases cited by appellant undermine the board's decision that compensation under 351, as it was known at the time of the 1980 board decision, did not require documentation. In any event, even if appellant could raise some question as to whether the state common law could be applicable in 1980, it does not meet the Q standard of showing undisputable error. Here, the board's analysis was sound, and even if appellant can inject some doubt into the soundness of the board's analysis, it's certainly debatable.
So let me, this is partially from Judge Meredith's question and your comment about the common law. There might be a distinction between the way you just framed it, right, which is that the common law provided the reason by which there is Q, meaning hypothetically the common law said X and the board didn't discuss it at the time and therefore that's Q, right? That, it seems to me, clearly wasn't presented. I suppose one could say it's not an error to discuss the common law if what you're saying is the statute at the time, properly interpreted, required or included informed consent, see A, B, C, D, and one of the subsidiary reasons you say the statute meant that at the time was the universal common law. Would the Secretary see those two things as being different, meaning one being a theory of Q, the other being an argument by which you interpret a statute under a theory you actually did make? Do you see what I mean?
I think I do, Your Honor. I think we would agree with that.
Okay. I'm not saying that's necessarily what's happening here. I just want to get the line drawn.
Could I follow up on that point, too? So do you read the appellant has suggested that the Q motion, even though it didn't specifically talk about 3.358, implicitly was making an assertion that the board in 1980 misinterpreted that regulation or specifically the word negligence? Do you read the Q motion itself as making any arguments about how the board in 1980 erred in applying either the regulation or specifically the term negligence?
Your Honor, I think that was generally the argument, even though 3.358 wasn't mentioned. I think it was certainly implicated, and that's why we didn't contest that.
Do you see the word negligent in the Q motion other than in the background section?
No, Your Honor. So back in 1980, the reference to negligence was in, of course, 3.358 and not in the statute, unlike today, was in both 1151 and 3.361.
So do you see a distinction between, I think VA conceded that we would have jurisdiction to discuss 3.358 in the context of saying, was the board in 2021 correct or incorrect in saying that the law had changed, that we could talk about 3.358 in that regard? But if it's seen as an argument that in 1980 the board misapplied 3.358, you're suggesting that even though it was a representative appellant that didn't mention that section, that's a theory of Q that is before us.
We did, Your Honor, and taking a close look with the supplemental briefing about whether we could make an argument that this court doesn't have jurisdiction. We thought that the natural inference from the Q motion would have been that it was raising 3.358 and it was proper for the board to address it and this court would have jurisdiction. So we would concede to that. Yes, Your Honor. And if there's no further questions, I just ask that you affirm.
I am.
Go. No, you can go first, Your Honor.
So the allegations that were presented in the Q motion, the appellant laid out the two statutory provisions and one regulatory provision that basically, do you read it as a plain language argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I think it is. And I think that's how the board addressed it as well.
Do you read anything in the Q motion or in the pleadings suggesting that the appellant has demonstrated or has tried to demonstrate that those particular three provisions undebatably in 1980 required the result that the appellant seeks? On a plain language basis of those three provisions alone, did they compel the result that the appellant is seeking? Has he shown that?
No, he hasn't shown that, but I think that's the implication of what the argument is and the fact that it was in the form of a Q motion. Did that answer your question?
Close.
So I have two related questions. The first is, I just want to get your position on something that I asked appellant so that I've got both, which is, if there is no evidence of what the practice was in 1980 with respect to informed consent and disability compensation under 351, right? There's no, I'm assuming you have no evidence of that either, right?
Right, Your Honor.
Right, okay. So we have...
Actually, can I correct myself? So...
Yes.
What we do have in this case, and it's on the record on page 360, there was a medical opinion that was obtained about informed consent. And that the opinion says, in 1978 through 79, and the care here was in 78, in 1978-79, there was no community medical care standard that required an informed consent procedure to be undertaken for radiation treatment. So this is evidence on the record saying that there is no procedure or common standard that applied to VA at the time to provide informed consent. So we do have some evidence in this case that there was no standard here that was not met.
So that was a slightly, that's helpful, slightly different than my question, though. My question is,
if there's no evidence.
Let me make clear what I mean, the thing about which there is no evidence, right? We don't know one way or the other whether in 1980 VA ever granted disability compensation to anyone for a lack of informed consent, right? I mean, are you aware of any evidence one way or the other about that?
I'm not, Your Honor. No.
Right. We can argue about whether the law provided it or not. Okay. So we have this sort of the center of the donut. We got the donut hole of evidence here, right? We don't know one way or the other whether VA actually ever did this at the time. What, if any, legal implication does that have?
Well, Your Honor, for a Q motion, the appellant or the movement has a burden of persuading that there's been clear and unmistakable error. So unless there's a showing that there was some error based on here, there was some regulation that required it or some statute, the motion would have to be denied because the Q is supposed to be a rare type of error that's not commonly found. So especially, I think, for a Q motion, it would have to be denied in the absence of anything showing whether there was a requirement for informed consent.
And my last question is because Mr. Luck mentioned these words right as he was sitting down, and so I'm going to ask you to expound on that in your reply, Mr. Luck. He mentioned Percy Avalli and George. What do you have to say about either one of those and how they might or might not affect this case?
Your Honor, to the extent that those cases provide an overall discussion of Q and the Q standards. It's consistent with, I think, what our position is, and I don't think those cases really have any impact on looking back in 1980 or looking at the board's decision in 2020. I don't think that those cases change anything as far as the analysis with this case.
And just to wrap that up, there's no, as far as you understand it, there's nothing in Persia Valley that would suggest that somehow the board didn't adjudicate the theory that was actually asserted by appellant?
Yeah, our position is not that. We would not make that contention. We think that the board addressed the contention that was raised in the Q motion.
Thank you.
Do you have anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Hamill.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Mr. Luck. And at some point during your time, if you could, right at the end, you said that if we didn't rule in your favor, it would, you know, be in violation of Persia Valley and George, or words to that effect. And so at some point, tell me what you think the implications of those two decisions are here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So we know Persia Valley and George came after Ms. Hatfield's Q pleadings. They came after the board's decision, and they provided much needed insight not only to the Q pleadings themselves, but also in terms of how the board accepted Ms. Hatfield's Q pleadings and recharacterized them into something that they were not. In
so explain that to me, recognizing that even though the three people on this panel happen to be a certain part of the Persia Valley decision, we all, I think I can speak for us all, we feel compelled to follow that decision, whatever it may mean, following George. So if you think that's binding and provides clarity on something in this case, if you can be specific, that would be helpful to me.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Ms. Hatfield is well aware of the panel and the panel's concurrence in the opinion in Persia Valley. In Persia Valley, the majority found that Mr. Persia Valley provided a Q theory based on the law that existed at the time, but the board recharacterized it as something for retroactivity of a current law. And that's exactly what the board did in this case. Was Ms. Hatfield's Q motion only mentioned authority that existed at the time of the 1980 board decision, but the board went outside of the authority that existed at the time and relied on the current law and used that to interpret and recharacterize Ms. Hatfield's Q claim as one stating that, well, the current law says this, therefore you lose on your Q claim. That's similar to what happened in Persia Valley. And Ms. Hatfield does want to say that Ms. Hatfield, she does agree with the majority's acknowledgement of this panel's concurrence regarding Q pleadings themselves, and certainly would take those serious and under consideration.
Well, if we're going to go if we're going to go down the Persia Valley, let's go the whole way. So, what about the portion of the whichever portion of the decision it is, it's difficult to call majority, minority, whatever, in the shifting coalitions there. But Mr. Hamill just mentioned as far as I can tell, the only evidence in the record about the state of informed consent for radiation treatments in 1978 and 79. What about Judge Lohr and Judge Jaquith's position about harmless error?
Great question, Your Honor. So first, just in reference to record at 360, that actually didn't exist at the time of the 1980 board decision. And so denying a Q claim based on a new VA exam that says, well, here's what I understood the law to mean, or the general medical principles to be is not the same thing as law and record that existed at the time of the 1980 board decision. But on that note, in reference to an earlier question you asked to me, in can we consider authority post 1980 board decision to inform us as to what the 1980 law said, I think this really does speak to an R&B issue on the...
It's okay. For a brief moment, I thought I was having a stroke, but it was just a cell phone, thank goodness. So, continue.
regain my train of thought.
The little elf-like music threw you off, Mr. Luck? Come on.
I am full of the Christmas spirit. So to the reasons and bases that... that the board provided. So I think if we're going to go down the road as to we can consider authority that existed after the 1980 board decision to inform us what the law at the time said, then we need to consider all of it, not just pick and choose what's favorable to the board's position in that case. And specifically, one of the things that Ms. Hatfield would like to note is that there is an OGC presidential opinion from 1994, December 1994 exactly, that interprets Section 351 and 3.358 and states that compensation is payable resulting from VA for injury resulting from VA treatment, causes additional disability or death, and the injury is not a risk of which the veteran was informed before consenting to undergo treatment, and actually provides the example that a medical procedure performed on a veteran without his or her consent, quote, compensation would be payable for the resulting disability or death. So if we're going to go down that road, we need to talk about everything that is informing our understanding of what 351 and 3.358 said at the time of the 1980 board decision.
One more question on the Percivelli point. Did the board, in your view, adjudicate the motion that you made, meaning you made a motion that referred to three specific sources of law, two statutes and one regulation? I understand that you think the board erred because it mentioned another regulation, but leave that aside. Did it adjudicate the motion that you made?
Ms. Hatfield's motion was about the law that existed at the time and how that law was understood. The board adjudicated what the law says now and used what the law says now as a basis to deny Ms. Hatfield's Q allegation.
So is your position that the board adjudicated the motion but did it incorrectly, or... So, because the argument in Percivelli was, I made a motion on this theory, the plain language of the regulation allowed this particular type of rating. The board adjudicated that as a motion that tried to apply a later judicial decision to an earlier time. So the majority in Percivelli said the theory of Q was unadjudicated. Okay. Is that your claim here, that your theory was unadjudicated, or is your claim that the board adjudicated it but did it incorrectly by referring to a change later to understand what the law was at the time?
It's actually both, Your Honor. So the board recharacterized Ms. Hatfield's Q claim as one essentially for a retroactive application of 3.361 and then relied on that to say, sorry, this didn't exist at the time. So I think in recharacterizing Ms. Hatfield's Q claim, it didn't address what the law said, or excuse me, how the law was understood under George at the time of the 1980 board decision, which is one of the critical requirements that was established by George. And in establishing what the law said through the lens of 3.361 is different than how the law was understood given the authority that existed at the time. And that's where Percivelli is analogous. Now, the board statement of reasons and bases relying on subsequent authority is, I think, a separate issue that requires remand by itself. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It channels judgment, it's close enough, yes.
I just have, recognizing that the parties can't concede jurisdiction, I have one follow-up question on that. In Johnston v. Nicholson, the Federal Circuit held that a representative counsel has to identify in the Q motion the particular provision in the regulation on which he relies. And in that case, they found that even though counsel had discussed 4.16C, that wasn't enough to raise an argument later on about 4.16B. So could you give us an idea of why that wouldn't be applicable here, of where a motion didn't mention the words negligence or didn't argue about negligence and didn't talk about 3.358, how we could now address whether the board in 1980 erred in failing to properly apply that regulation?
Oh, and even if your time runs out, please continue to answer, Judge Merritt.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the board addressed 3.358.
Finding that the law changed, but as to whether the board in 1980 erred is what I'm talking about.
So I think why the court has jurisdiction here is, again, viewing the board's understanding of the scope of Ms. Hatfield's Q claim, but recognizing that Ms. Hatfield's Q claim did not reference specifically 3.358 to the extent that the board did address it as a separate matter or maybe a separate Q claim in and of itself, that has the res judicata effect of precluding those arguments from subsequently being raised later. And I think that because the court has jurisdiction over all matters in a case denied by or brought under the umbrella of the Q theory that were addressed by the board, that's how the court has jurisdiction in this case.
So. Why don't you just briefly wrap up, Mr. Buck?
Thank you, Your Honor. So just in summation, there's no dispute the law required informed consent. Congress established that duty on the part of the VA in 1980. The only way to give teeth to that protection of those veterans' rights is to read Section 3.358C3 as a non-exhaustive list that includes a failure to obtain informed consent to serve as a proximate cause for compensation benefits. Otherwise, the obligation to obtain informed consent that was created by Congress becomes discretionary because there is no mechanism of enforcement without understanding that that serves as the proximate cause. Under Section 351, Congress sought to protect veterans from medical malpractice by establishing compensation for the VA's failure to do so or for VA's violation and medical malpractice. That same protection carries over with the requirement of informed consent. And the board's determination that Section 3.358C3 precluded a lack of informed consent to serve as a proximate cause, I think, was an error of law, and it also violated Percy Valley and George by relying on this subsequent authority to interpret what 3.358C3 actually said. So I think pursuant to Percy Valley and George, remand is necessary here for the board to re-adjudicate under the proper legal framework.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we want to thank the parties for your helpful submissions and your argument here today. It's nice to see everybody present in the courtroom. And with that, the case is submitted. Thank you.
All rise.